You know what you won't get when you support independent media and pledge your support at rabble.ca/donate? No tote bag, no pens, no mugs. It's not a swag thing. Pledging at rabble.ca/donate keeps Rabble's news and views for the rest of us surviving and maybe even thriving. That's rabble.ca/donate. See you there.
You're listening to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, 102.7 FM.
This month, the Vancouver Island Public Interest Research Group launched a campaign on the policing of poverty. The campaign call is to create a safer city for all people, regardless of their social and economic status. This action follows on the heels of their study on the policing of poverty. The study found that poor and street-involved people are the targets of much more frequent police attention than their activities call for. Police fill the gap in social and health services with interventions that criminalize and harm people who are poor and often disabled, mentally ill, or drug-addicted. The researchers interviewed over 100 members of the Victoria Street community. Mark Wilson is a researcher with Vancouver Island PIRG, and he's joined us to talk about that report called Out of Sight, Policing Poverty in Victoria, Coast, and Straits Salish Territories. Hello, Mark, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Good morning, Peter.
So, the people you talk to, what range of social and health challenges do they face on a day-to-day basis?
Folks spoke about things that I think a lot of us do face ourselves. It's just it's more pronounced when you don't have social supports to deal with them. So it's everything ranging from chronic illnesses, drug use issues, physical and mental disabilities.
And these are street involved, as in, like, we hear that term, we think homeless people, but these are also just people low income and in housing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think homeless tends to suggest that everyone stays in the same position constantly. And what I think a lot of research finds is that people are in a spectrum of housing. So you may be housed for a certain amount of time. You may be housed in an SRO for a certain amount of time, and you may find yourself on the street depending on your monthly circumstances. So we're dealing with a range of folks who are using services in these areas because they are living in extreme poverty, but are living in a range of housed and unhoused situations.
And one of the key issues the report attempts to highlight is social profiling by police. How does profiling play out in the encounters between Victoria Police and the people you talked with?
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, this is something that they've been looking at quite a bit out east, which is when people are stopped based on their appearance and then given a ticket afterwards for whatever it may be. So that was the impression a lot of folks we'd interviewed had, which is that they were stopped on a regular basis in a given month and sometimes given tickets, you know, for loitering, trespassing, and these kinds of things, or simply just stopped and searched and having their belongings confiscated. And so this is the kind of targeting that we were surprised by the frequency of it. These are things that we kind of knew were going on and that led to us doing the research, because these are things that aren't often tracked. But the amount that folks are being stopped and the types of stories we found were quite surprising to us.
So as opposed to uncovering someone's behavior and taking them for it, they first target someone and then they uncover their trespass.
That's the interesting part. I mean, I think there's an impression that there's criminal behavior going on and that the police are brought in to address visible criminal behavior on the streets. But what we found in them for the most part here was that people are being stopped and being asked to move along and these kinds of things simply for being in public space. And I think once someone's stopped, you can always find a reason to ticket them or to harass them, whether it's for having certain types of drug paraphernalia and various other reasons.
What did people, what did you hear from them about the effect of police confiscations of their personal property?
I mean, this is probably some of the hardest stories that we came across. Was, I mean, you're dealing with a range of folks who are living in really precarious circumstances and are just struggling to get by on a day-to-day basis. And some of people's most important things they carry around with them for survival were being taken away. And this impacts both mental and physical health. Like, on one hand, we talked to a good, I mean, 50% of the folks we talked about having their photos and sleeping bags, money and ID taken away at various points. And these are the kinds of things that make digital life virtually impossible. I think people seem to most obviously upset about losing family photos and these kinds of things. Because for folks who are often alienated from their families and these kinds of things, these are a great way of emotional support and this kind of thing. On the other hand, on the physical well-being, we were surprised that people reported having a lot of their safer consumption supplies confiscated as well, so people could go in and be carrying around clean needles, water, and these kinds of things, and would be losing those through their contact with police as well. So in terms of your straight-up physical well-being, avoiding HIV and these kinds of things, there's a clear threat to people's well-being.
It almost sounds like confiscation is a light term for having your money or sleeping bag taken by someone with a gun.
Yeah, we've been calling it stealing because I think straight up it is stealing people's stuff and making it very difficult for folks to get it back. There's two things going on there. I mean, I think some of the stories we ran into were a straight up, this is gone, you're never going to see it again type story, which is well outside of the Police Act code. On the other hand, I think there's an above board version of this stealing, which is the confiscation mood is we're taking this, and you can come collect it later on, which is there's a lot of barriers to collecting that stuff afterwards. I mean, I think there's a first barrier, which is do folks understand that they can actually come and get it, which is often unclear. And secondly, you have to get the money together, the whatever, 20 or so bucks, go down to the police station, fill out the forms and these kinds of things, which is a pretty clear barrier to a lot of people getting their stuff back.
Now, the study also looked at the types of interactions police had with people who have mental health and addictions issues. What did you find out about the effectiveness of the different interactions?
Well, it seemed, like to be generous, our reading is that there's a fairly aggravated sensibility in these interactions. I mean, our feeling is that police don't have the training, and police have said this many times in Vancouver and Victoria, they don't have the training to do these types of interactions. And it tends to escalate hostility when you have police that are trained in authority and ensuring people obey them, and you're going into a range of people who may have issues with that, need a range of forms of listening to be going on. It tends to escalate the problem and lead to forms of violence and these kinds of things. So it definitely, we heard lots of stories about forms of violence, forms of acting rude and fairly uncivil in these engagements, which I think is, you know, pushing police well beyond their capacities and clearly is harming the people who are being interacted with there. And the thing to remember there, too, is, again, these are non-criminal offenses. These are people who are being stopped for very mild everyday activities and then being faced with these types of kind of harsh interactions.
Mark, why did you decide to call the report Out of Sight?
We were trying to hone on a few things that are going on there, and we've hit on three, and I'm almost expanding it to four just based on some of our experiences in the last few weeks. But first off, out-of-sight ticketing is a term they've used to describe what happens when you're stopped because of the way you look and then are given a ticket on top of that. They kind of developed the term, as far as I understand, out in Ontario as a way of describing the reason black drivers were getting a lot of tickets for, say, not having their driver's licenses, which was proof that black folks were getting pulled over, and then afterwards, police are finding reasons to ticket folks where, you know, you don't have your insurance, you don't have your ID, and these kinds of things. So this is something we felt was going on here. People are being stopped because they look poor. They're not supposed to be in that area because they look poor. And then you're finding a range of reasons to give them the ticketing. The second way we can understand out of sight is the reason that folks are being targeted as well by the city. So there's a number of bylaws in town that have been put in to keep people out of certain spaces and to encourage police to get people to move along. And we feel like this is a clear out-of-sight issue where the city is trying to move poverty out of sight of the population. Two of the biggest bylaws involve rules about where you can stand, sit, and kneel, like if it's on a median or on the sidewalk. And they're pretty clear-cut, which is that, I mean, unless you're walking, unless you're sitting and waiting for the bus, you shouldn't be there. So there's a lot of discretion on the part of police about who gets targeted for these kinds of things, and obviously we have a sense of who's being targeted. So we do think that the bylaws are encouraging these forms of social profiling that the police are engaging in. The third type of out-of-sight that we believe is going on is that these things just simply aren't reported, and they aren't recorded either. So we were trying to offer a snapshot of the types of targeting and the types of policing practices that are going on in the downtown core there that aren't, there's no other way of keeping track of them. If you're not given a ticket, there's no record of your interaction with a police officer, regardless of what it is. And this seems to us to be a real problem, because if you're dealing with oversight of policing practices, it can only happen if you know exactly what's going on. So we feel like this is a first step in trying to introduce some sort of tracking practices so you know when people have been stopped and there's just some clear records of these kinds of things. And I guess the fourth one we're running into on the out-of-sight line is that I think this is a hard problem to get people to take seriously. They've been fighting for it for about a decade out east, and it's only recently that cities are recognizing, hey, social and racial profiling are happening, and we need to take a strong stand on it. I think there's a certain amount of denial here in Victoria that these things are happening. The police force has denied it. It's unclear whether the city is willing to take a strong stand on it, so we think it's pretty important to say, hey, let's look at the research, let's look at what they found in other cities, and try not to deny that this is happening, and try to bring it into sight in terms of the practices that are actually going on.
Now, how do the street-involved people experience police interventions compared to the general population doing similar things, say trespassing or public intoxication?
Yeah, I mean, some of these stories were interesting. I mean, it came out in part through our own interviews. So we were using a process called a peer methodology, which is an important type of community-based research where the people who are conducting the interviews are actually members, experiential members of the street population and folks who've been there and kind of understand the circumstances. And what was happening is that even while people were conducting the interviews on the street, they were being asked to move along by the police simply because of the way they looked or the person they were standing with looked. So I think there is a pretty clear sense among interviewers as well as the folks who are interviewing that there is this kind of permanent and constant inability to stand for even a few minutes in particular areas of the city.
What kinds of responses did people have when you asked them about their confidence in the Victoria Police?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't come as too much of a surprise once we'd heard all these stories, but certainly confidence was much lower than you would get when we were looking at the types of responses you would get in national surveys. And this is a difficult thing, which is you're dealing with a range of folks who are living in precarious circumstances and who need support, but they have a very low confidence in the police's ability to offer these kinds of support. So again, I think it points to a misuse of city funds, where we're paying the police more and more to target this particular group. They tend to get targeted in a fairly harsh way that often breaks Police Act code. And what's needed on the street is a whole different set of services and forms of interaction.
And you're actually planning to approach the Victoria City Council on March 8th with a proposal. What are you asking them to do?
Well, we want to start with a proposal that does something that's happened in Montreal last month, which is straight up, a recognition that these things are happening. So we would like City Hall to adopt a proposal that says, hey, we recognize that social profiling is occurring. We want to take a strong stand against it. So I think this is a possibility because, I mean, the city has been pretty good about taking stands on things. They've got a seven-point sort of set of plans, and one of them includes harm reduction, which we think is important. And I think if we can add this to that list, it's a good move. And I think the two things that come out of that are first a strong stand against these types of activities on the street, instituting a number of, probably a committee to look into it and say, hey, can we set up a way of monitoring these types of activities and ensuring that they don't happen? Secondly, we would like the city to look much more closely at the police budget that it's considering right now. So on the table right now, the city is looking at a 3% increase to the police budget, which amounts to about $2 million. And a lot of it has to do with increased police caseload. So the police caseload at this point, they estimate about 30% of it has to do with poverty-related issues. And they're expecting it to go up to 50% within the year. So a lot of this increase has to do with providing more resources for police to be engaged in policing poverty. We believe that this money could be much more well spent and reallocated towards a range of social services in terms of income supports and housing and these kinds of things.
Do you have any sense if the makeup of the city council would be sympathetic to proposals like this?
I think so. I mean, I think it's a good crew that's leaning towards social democratic principles, and I believe that if there's a barrier at all, I think it has to do with habit. Like, I believe that what we've seen with police budgets is that they tend to increase regardless, because I think there's a misconception of what safety means in a city. I think if you accept that there's a criminal element that needs to be policed, and these are our main concerns, then the police budget will always continue to rise. Social services will always be a question mark there, depending on what's left. What we're suggesting here is that these aren't criminal activities at all. And in fact, what we're seeing is a habit that has led to police being brought in to deal with social issues. A lot of it has to do with the downloading responsibilities from the provinces and the feds, which is that cities powers have traditionally laid with bylaw enforcement, zoning, and these kinds of things, which involve policing to ensure those things. So I think it's going to take a little bit of creativity, which a lot of cities are having to experiment with, which is how do we rethink the way we're managing our resources and use them wisely. And I think this is an excellent spot to look at some of this creative management that is going to use what we have to actually make the city safer for everyone. We don't want it just to be a space that's policed so it looks clean. We want it to be a spot where everyone can be safe because they have the supports they need to lead good lives, I guess, so they're well being supported.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for joining us today and sharing the results of your research, and good luck approaching City Council.
Absolutely. One last thing I'll add in there is if anyone wants more information, you can look at our website. It's viperg.ca. We've got our reports. We've got all of our recent media releases on there and lots of good information in terms of getting a sense of what the issues are and how this relates to other issues across Canada. And for anyone who's interested in speaking to City Hall on March 8th, you can contact us directly through that website. And you can also go to the City Hall website and sign in to speak on that day, to speak either to your experiences or your sense of the injustices that are going on here.
Well, we'll restate that website again later. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot.
I've been speaking with Mark Wilson, a researcher with Vancouver Island Public Interest Research Group. The report on the policing of poverty called Out of Sight is available on their website at viperg.ca, viprg.ca. And you can also find a link to that report on our website at cooperadio.org/redeye.